Yeah. I want to welcome all of you today. I think it's appropriate to give a special welcome to Barbara's mother. I want to make sure Carol knows that Barbara's mother is living just a few miles from this, and I hope you've made that connection already. Now, we're looking in the book of Revelation, and in the spirit of trying to get you ready for things that are coming, I want to take just 1 second and have you look at something in chapter 5. Once we've done this, it won't take longer, but this will get you thinking a little bit more about things that are coming after we finish walking through the letters to the churches. Chapter 5 says, I saw that in the right hand of the one sitting on the throne there was a scroll written on the back and front, and sealed with 7 seals. And I saw a powerful angel who called with a loud voice, who is worthy to open the scroll and break it, the scroll and break its seals. But there was no one in heaven or on the earth or under the earth who was able to open the scroll and read it. I wept bitterly because no one could be found to open the scroll and read it. But one of the elders said to me, do not weep. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah is triumphant, and so he will open the scroll and its 7 seals. And I saw, and I'm going to pause there for a moment. You were John, and you had just heard this. What would you be looking for? No one was worthy. And then an angel said to me, do not weep. Look, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has triumphed. So when you look, what are you looking for? You're looking for a lion. What do you see? A lion. I just want you to get that contrast thoroughly in your mind before we get to chapter 5. The lion is triumph, and when you look, it's not a lion. It's a lamb. We're going to talk about that contrast a little bit. I'm just going to let that sit. If you'll back up now to Revelation chapter 2, we're ready to look at the second letter. Before we start this letter, let's review. What's the content? What's the structure of these letters? The letters open with? Even before that. Write the name of which may name the master or leader of the church at so-and-so. And then what comes next? Nope. Nothing before that. A description of the risen Lord. Then comes a praise or commendation, followed by a criticism or condemnation, and then followed by a promise to those who will hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Okay. I want to remind you of something. I'll start doing this each week. At the end of each letter, it does say, let him who has ears hear what the Spirit says to the church. Says, let him who has ears hear what it says to the church yet. That's plural, which is why a lot of people believe all 7 of these letters are written to churches. Different letters to different churches at different times. A given church might have one of these letters more appropriate at one time than another. Okay? Now, in that spirit, what's unique, or almost unique, what's special about the letter to Smyrna? Well, let's read it to see if you can find out. Write to the angel of the church in Smyrna and say, here is the message of the first and the last who was dead and has come to life again. I know your hardships and your poverty, and though you are rich, I know the slander of the people who falsely claim to be Jews but are really members of the synagogue of Satan. Do not be afraid of the sufferings that are coming to you. Look, the devil will send some of you to prison to put you to the test, and you must face hardship for 10 days. Even if you have to die, keep faithful. And I will give you the crown of life for your prize. Let anyone who can hear listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. For those who prove victorious will come to no harm from the special about this letter. He's responsible. Nevertheless, he's admitting. The condemnation or the criticism that follows that phrase, nevertheless, is missing. This is a church. Jesus isn't criticizing. So what did he give? He gave him praise, and then what? Encouragement. Now I want to review just a little bit. But in front of the translation, in front of my translation, if you remember the structure, write to the letter, write to the angel, and say here is the message of, and there's a description of Jesus, right? Immediately after that, and usually in my translation of the phrase, I know such and such about you. And that's usually the praise or the commendation part. And then the word nevertheless or something equivalent to that, I think some translations have the word yet. And that's what's missing out of this. Go back to the I know this about you. What does it say? It talks about hardship. Now, hang on. Let's go one word at a time. I heard somebody give another word for this one. Tribulation. Suffering. Affliction. Is there any other word? I'm only the first word. First word. Okay. I know your hardship, one translation says. I know your suffering, another translation says. I know your affliction, another one. Okay. Second word. I know your poverty. Are there other words for that in your translation?
I have that too.
Mine says, though you are rich. Now, there's a third one, and the third one is slander. Hardship or suffering or tribulations or affliction, poverty. I know your hardship, I know your poverty, and I know the slander that you're enduring. Sure, you know what those three words mean. The word that is translated hardship, the word that is translated poverty, the word that is translated slander. So,
nice and flat.
That's an interesting word for a translation to use. I am told that if you look at the Greek word that's talking about this, the best way to tell you what that means is to say this. Drowning in trouble. What does that imply? What does that imply? Overwhelming? What else? Well, not necessarily hopelessness, but it looks like that's all an ordinary person without connection to Jesus would say. The kind of things that without Jesus, you would be helpless. Okay? But drowning in trouble says overwhelming. What else does it say? I think it says nothing else.
There is a kind.
Yeah, need rescuing, yeah. I hear numerous. It's not one thing. And it's not two, and it's not three. My granddaddy used to say the crows just count. Are you old enough from the farm to know this one, of course? Because any time you go hunting, if you hunt crows, I have no idea why people of this generation hunted crows. I don't think they were particularly good for eating, but maybe they were desperate, I don't know. But he said any time you go hunting for crows, you take a group into the woods bigger than three. Leave some people behind and have a group of three come out. And crows could count to three, they see more than three go in, they see three go out, they assume everybody is gone, and they come back out. It's not one, it's not two, it's not three, it's so many you can hardly count them. And drowning in trouble implies the trouble is coming from every direction you can imagine. What directions do trouble come from for people like us? Where do our troubles come from? We talked about a few of them this morning in our prayer time. Where do our troubles come from? Health issues. Money issues. Economics. What else?
Family.
I may not be worried about me, but I'm dying with worry about somebody that I that's very close to me. Where else? Yeah, same. That's relationships, I think. With an understanding that family represents a special category of that, is maybe it's important right there. So. And there might be others. And the picture I get is that adding to this, the cause of these words here, is for them something we don't usually experience. But for them, it's supposed to be at a level that's almost incomprehensible for us. It would be pretty much impossible for us to imagine those kinds of problems. And probably more. And the trouble was coming from every side. The way the system works, if you don't knuckle under the system, you don't eat. The way the system works, if you don't knuckle under the system, if you don't do the things they want you to do, emperor worship and all those kinds of things, all of a sudden you don't have access to the places or the things that might help you keep your health. Your family members or your friends taken away. So the kinds of things we experience multiply. I heard somebody this last week, the character in the novel had come home from being at the front, the day out of war. And his family asked him what the life is at the front. And he said, imagine the worst you can imagine. Multiply by 10. Multiply by 10 again. And you might have won 10,000 of how bad it is. But where we sit, this is at a level we can't imagine. Don't hear this word as soft. Hear this word as horrible. Drowning in trouble. What's poverty mean? Poverty sort of says there's something real big about that. The phrase in Greek, I'm told, means you don't have 2 dimes to run together. You don't have 2 dimes to run together. You don't know where you're going to eat the next meal. You don't know how you're going to take care of anybody that's of importance to you, much less yourself. And little or no hope of changing that. And then the phrase comes, and yet you are rich. Now that's the phrase I want you to see in context. It's about certain things I've just said. That's never going to come alive to you.
Yeah. Normally, many types of things. We drove from her home, got the car, stay there. Jim Carvey and money, representing money to them. And here in the United States, I feel like we've got to give a lot of something to give somebody like that. There, if you gave them a tamale, was just a tenth of a penny. If you had a tamale or two, to give them, you know, that was just incredibly, you know, they've been incredibly wealthy. They but in our day, sometimes I would have, you know, that my child would try to do something. And you would think, well, you know, like, you know, you see their children's bellies and children, and, you know, they're starving. And, but sure you think, I'll give them a loaf of bread. There is like half of a piece of bread, even, you know, anything, tomato, an egg, potato, you know.
I remember when Barbara and I went to Africa for the first time, we went to Tanzania and thought we were seeing a country that was suffering from poverty. We went to the marketplace with Bill and Sandy Harrington. They could speak Swahili, so we could survive there. And I remember thinking, or this stuff. And Bill and Sandy looked at me and said, no, 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 you misunderstand. There's food here in the marketplace. 10 years ago when we first came, you come to the marketplace, there's no food.
the way the country was in that time, the communist government was in control. And things, they said, are so much better. You may think it looks bad. This is paradise compared to where it was. Shortly after that, Jim and Judy Carter came. Their children had been, I think, in Mozambique. They had gone to Mozambique first and then come to Tanzania. And they said when they arrived, this is paradise. We just came from Mozambique. We know what this looks like. We don't have a sense of what this looks like. Now listen. Grinding poverty. Hardships, so many you can't count them, you're drowning in them. And yet, you are rich. Okay? Now, I'm not going to tell you why, but I want you to hold that in for the next few weeks. Because it's going to come a day when it's very, very important. Now I'm going to leave. I don't want to tell you about it. Keep your eye on that. God's value system is not the world's value system. By the world's value system, these people were killed. But they had something the world doesn't normally have. And that made them rich. Here's a church that seemingly has nothing. And Jesus says, I agree, you have almost nothing. But what you have makes you the wealthiest people in the region. Now what does that do for you? Most of you are not suffering from this level. Whatever trouble you have, most of you, most of the time, please hear me. What did I not say? I didn't say all of you, and I didn't say all the time, because there are some of you, some of the time, who do meet that first test. I've watched and I've watched you work through it. I've heard you say, I don't know how people get through this without a church family to help you through it. But most of us, most of the time, don't meet that first test. And if we did, we would think we'd meet the world. And here's Jesus' assessment. There are things that are more important than money. There are things that are more important than health. Maybe there's things that are more important than family and relationships. Because the kind of relationships and family you get in the Lord is a different level. Sometimes that gets replaced. And sometimes whether you have money or not is not the most important thing. Now, it's tempting to flop over and not pay attention to that category, but it may be the most important. It may be the most important. What's the word slander? Somebody tell you something that is true. That is absolutely right. That is also, in my opinion, right. I don't think that came along. Or slander. It's something that's not true that is designed to accomplish what? To cut the ground under you and make you fall. That's what slander is. Slander has a purpose, and the purpose is to destroy. It's to destroy a good name. It's to destroy an influence that you might have. It's to destroy a position that you might have. Slander is designed to cut the ground from under you and make you fall. Where's the slander coming from? I'm looking at verse 9. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. But then let's check. Does that make up anti-Semitism?
Say yes.
Careful. Does that make up anti-Semitism?
No.
If we notice that. No. Because the writer makes absolutely sure that you understand where it's really coming from. It's coming through a particular group at this time. Let the time go to another time, it's going to come through another group. But where does it always come from? It comes from the Word of God. What is the most important characteristic of God? What an unfair question. What an unfair question. The one that's important at this moment is he is creative. He makes something out of nothing. What is Satan's most important characteristic in contrast to that?
He is the destroyer. He makes nothing out of nothing. And the slander is designed to do that. Here's the phrase that I heard. I'm going to write this down as far as you. The very basis of your life called into question. The very basis of your life called into question. Let's put this three together. Driving in trouble, not a dime to your name. The very basis of your life in question from your enemies. And yet, you are rich. Which one would you rather do? No troubles at all? Plenty of money and no slander coming at you? Or would you rather be a member of the church this morning? Which would you rather have? Jesus said, that begins to let you know where you stand. The richest people on earth, drowning in struggle, not a dime here none, the very basis of your existence, called into question by the river. And yet, you are rich. Why are they rich?
With the reference to Jews, it says, you say they are Jews and are not, my father thinks they were reference. I look back to Romans chapter 2.
Isn't it nice to have a study Bible?
Yeah. Romans 2:28-29. Says, a man is not a Jew, but he is only one outward, nor is circumcision merely outward and physical. No, a man is a Jew if he is one inward. And circumcision is circumcision of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the written code. Such a man's praise is not from men, but from God.
Some of you may remember that the first time circumcision is talked about in the Bible, in that very book, in Deuteronomy, it says, it's really important to circumcise your heart, to end with your own and outward. Now, let me take you a step further. I'm now in verse 10. Do not be afraid of the sufferings that are coming to you. The devil will send some of you to prison to put you to the test, and you must face hardship. There's that word again. I think it's in the singular this time. You must face trouble at overwhelming levels for 10 days. Even if you have to die, keep faithful, and I will give you the crown of life for your pride. How long do you have to suffer? Well, that's not very long. We could be finished by Thursday or next week. This is Revelation, folks. What's that 10 days mean? What should it be in contrast to? When he talks about the great tribulation, the worst trouble that big, huge groups of people ever experienced, how long was that supposed to last? 7 days. And 3.5 days was the middle of it. But everybody who reads this stuff says, well, you know, what that really means is what? Years. And he doesn't say you have to suffer 3.5. He doesn't say you have to suffer 7. He says you may have to suffer 10. What's he just talking about? What does the number 10 represent? Many. If you start thinking like the Western liberalist that you may be, but that's, oh, Thursday next week, oh, yeah, I can do that. I believe it's possible you might have said that. I don't know. Maybe you will. But that's one of the longest periods of time you see us talk about it, by the way. It's not 7 days. It's not 3.5 days. And that's me. And that's a long time. How long can you live drowning in troubles grinding poverty in the very basis of your life calling into question. You're talking about endurance at a level which is almost incomprehensible. And yet here is a group of people capable of that. Do you understand why Jesus doesn't criticize? I don't think I could do it. I think I've lived too long in that. I'm very sorry. I don't mean any disrespect. I don't think you did. I think there may be some people in some parts of the world who can't finish in my admiration. Even if you have to die, and I will give you the crown of life. Anybody remember what happens to that crown of life a little bit late? I can encourage you to read some chapters again. Anybody know what happens with the people who have the crown of life? They throw them on the ground before the throne. What's the crown symbolize? Victory and accomplishment. Standing. What does throwing it down represent? Knowing that God is really the source of that. The people in Smyrna are not to be admired and praised. Jesus is to be admired and praised for the support he gives them to help them endure and to help them persevere. When God looks around, what's he looking for in chapter 5? He's looking for a lion. And what does he see? He sees a lion. If you can see what the Lord is doing, then chances are the value system of the world is no one very fond of you. The value system of the world is right, looks right to you. Chances are you're not going to see what God's all about. I'm glad you've been to church so far today. For the pastor to talk about that. Confusion. The cross makes no sense if you have the world's values when you look at it. That's the letter of the Smyrna. What kind of instructions do you have?
It just kind of struck me. I'm in trouble. I'm going to have to die. You're going to have to the very foundation on which you stand, and he says, do not be afraid of what you are about to suffer.
Thank you. Thank you. I think you just underscored some of the points that I made in Haiti. That's right. What you have experienced is nothing compared to what's coming, and it's going to come for a long time. And yes, you're called off to endure. I'm supposed to tell you that, aren't I?
I'm telling you.
While Ephesus was the most important city in Asia Minor, Smyrna was the loveliest. It was called the ornament of Asia, the crown of Asia, the flower of Asia, the Paris was the cities of Ionia. It was said to have a grace which extended over every part of the rainbow. The harbor was considered one of the most beautiful and safe in the world, 35 miles north of Ephesus. Smyrna had been destroyed earlier and had been rebuilt out of the ruins to become one of the most beautiful cities of the ancient world, and hence the identification of the author as the first and the last, the one who died and came to life again at second wind. It is said that Jews in Smyrna had donated 10,000 denarii for the beautification of the city, and hence it was called the Synagogue of Satan. The Jews there appear to have been especially hostile to the Christians, and even persuaded the Roman authorities to persecute them. It was here that Polycarp, some of you know something about church history, was martyred on February 23 of AD 155. He was the bishop of Smyrna at the time John wrote the Revelation. The statement of the time of his martyrdom was, 86 years have I served him, and he has done me no wrong. How can I now blaspheme my king and Savior? And I look at this. 60-70 years after John wrote, and here this guy is at 86 years old being martyred. The problem is that people have gone at least that long.
So now in addition to all this, and what I don't have to look forward to, I'm doing it in paradise.
That's right.
You know, that is more true. I asked you if you had any more comments on Smyrna. I do, if you'll permit. And you go back to Hebrews. Don't lose your place because if we have time, we're going to try to work on Pergamum, but we may not have time. It's time to do this one at a time. I want to ask you if anybody knows the title, the 1 Corinthians 13. I want to know if anyone knows the title of Hebrews 11. The faith chapter. Sometimes called the roll call of faith. He starts out and talks in verse 4 about the faith that Abel had. In verse 5, the faith that Enoch had. In verse 7, Noah. Verse 8, Abraham. And then he says in verse 13, all these died in faith before receiving any of the things that have been promised. But they saw them from far distance and welcomed them, recognizing that they were only strangers and nomads on the earth. Value system, value system. People would use such terms about themselves and make it quite plain they are in search of a homeland. If they had been the country they'd come from, they would have the opportunity to return to it, but they were longing for a better homeland, their heavenly homeland. This is why God is not ashamed to be called their God, because he has founded the city for them. And he picks back up, talks about Abraham in verse 17, Isaac in verse 20, Moses in verse 23, goes on and on and on. Anybody okay? Now, I want to start reading in verse 32. And I want you to watch very, very carefully how the writer lays this up for you. What more shall I say? There is not time for me to give an account of Gideon, or Barak, or Samson, or Jephthah, or David, or Samuel, or the prophet. He doesn't have time for David. He doesn't have time for Samuel. These were men who through faith conquered kingdoms, did what was upright, and earned the promises. They could keep alive, mouth shut, put out blazing fires, and emerge unscathed from battle. Now, I just stopped in the middle of verse 34. Did you stop with me? Don't look anymore. What kind of a group have you seen so far? Victorious. Powerful. Right? And suddenly, in the middle of 34, he starts saying something else. Is he saying it about the same group, or is he saying it about a different group? You judge as we read on. They were weak people who were given strength to be brave in war and drive back foreign invaders. That ring true? Weak people given strength? Now, maybe that's the same group, but now watch what. Verse 35. Some returned to their wives from the dead by resurrection. Powerful. Others submitted to torture, refusing release so that they would rise again to a better life. They didn't victory. They weren't victorious. Some had to bear being pilloried and flogged or even chained up in prison. They were stoned or sawn in half. A lot of people think that was Isaiah being described there. Or killed by the sword. They were homeless and wore only the skins of sheep and goats. They were in want and hardship, there's your word, and maltreated. They were too good for the world, and they wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and ravines. These all, the victors, and the ones who look like victims. These all won acknowledgement through their faith, but they did not receive what was promised, since God had made provision for them to have something better, and they were not to reach perfection, except with us. There were two groups in the Old Testament days, and there's still two groups. There's a group that's victorious and powerful, and there's a group that the world thinks are victims, and beneath us. But if the Lord is in us, they're both God's people. Church in Smyrna is from that second group. The troubles were overwhelming. The poverty was unbelievable.
the reasons to have had doubts now be larger than you can imagine. And yet they endured and they persevered. And God says that wins you a crown. A crown of life. How you doing? You want to start Pergamum? We've got about 8 minutes. Maybe we can do Pergamum in 8 minutes.
Well, you just gave us the reason they were rich. They want to say one prayer.
Right, an angel or the leader of the church of Pergamum and said, here's the message of the one who has the sharp sword, double-edged. I know where you live in a place where Satan is enthroned, and I know that you still hold firmly to my name and did not disown your faith in me, even when my faithful witness Antipas was killed among you where Satan lives. Nevertheless, I have one or two charges against you. Some of you are followers of Balaam, who taught Balak to set a trap for the Israelites so that they committed adultery by eating food that had been sacrificed to idols. And among you, too, there are some who follow the teaching of the Nicolaitans. So repent, or I shall come to you and attack these people with the sword out of my mouth, let anyone who is here listen to what the Spirit is saying to the churches. To those who prove victorious, I will give some hidden manna and a white stone with my name written on it. And that is not only to the person who receives it. What's good about Pergamum? They live in a hard place. A place that sounds a lot like Smyrna in some respects. And yet, they'll remain faithful. My phrase says, you still hold firmly to my name. Even in spite of one of the leaders being martyred, which normally would have at least had a threat of taking away the faith of the followers. We don't know anything else about that particular person. Whatever was coming in Smyrna, had already arrived in the body of Pergamum. Okay? That phrase, maybe not quite as high as Smyrna, but pretty high. And yet, in the middle of that, there is a yet. There is a nevertheless. Now, just in case you weren't here last week, or just in case you were and it made no sense, what do we know about Balaam? I think I know what's going on. Give me just a moment. I think it's Numbers 31. Numbers 22 to 25 is the original story. Did you guys do the homework I asked you to do? Did you look up Balaam and study about that? In Numbers, did you find Numbers? Don't go there. You can go there later. But Numbers 22 through 25 tells you the story, sort of the front end of the story of Balaam. And in the story of Balaam, there's a king of a group of people that the children of Israel are about to displace. They're beginning their move into the promised land, and this king realizes that what's going to happen to him is what's happened to other countries that are in the world. His country is going to be destroyed and displaced. A comment just for what it's worth. There are some commentators who think that if you look at this part and you start to ask, well, how could God have all these people killed just like room for these other people over here? Isn't that horrible? There are commentators who say that this is more, it's factual, but it is more than just the fact. It is an allegory of what happens when the Spirit comes into my heart if I'm a believer and what the Spirit is supposed to do to the sin that's in my heart. That sin is supposed to be displaced. It's supposed to be gone. And the taking over of the promised land is thought by these commentators to be an allegory or a parable. That is, the truth is there, but something beyond the outward, what have you. I leave sin in my life that the Spirit wants to take out but doesn't. Then the problem you see that the children of Israel have when they try to come to the promised land, I'm going to have parallel problems. But here is, if you will, a king, or in the outward, a sin in my life that wants to stay. So he goes to Balaam, a prophet, and he says, I want you to curse these people for me. Why, I can't do that. These are God's people. I can't do that. He said, look, I'll give you a lot of money if you'll curse these people. And he said, look, I don't think I can do it, but let me try going over here. Maybe from here I can do it. And he gets there and he finds out, no, I couldn't do it from here, but maybe if I do it this way. And he keeps doing this. Now, the story sort of fades out, and you have the sense that he's been impotent. He has not been able to accomplish his job. But then, over in Numbers 31, there's a little clue that he was way more successful than he thought. So if you'll find Numbers 31, verse 7, they made war on Midian as the Lord had ordered Moses, and put every male to death for his horn. They killed the kings of Midian, and they named those the five Midianite kings. And the end of verse 8, they also put Balaam, the son of Beor, to the sword. Now if you come down to verse 13, Moses, the priest, Eleazar, and all the leaders of the community went out into the camp, out of the camp to meet them. Moses was enraged with the officers of the army, the commanders of the thousands, commanders of the hundreds, who had come back from this military expedition. And he said, why did you spare the life of all the women? They were the very ones who, on Balaam's advice, caused the Israelites to be unfaithful to the Lord in the affair of Peor, and hence the plague which struck the Lord's community. And therefore, he goes on. He sounds bloody and hard, and I don't pretend to be able to explain that part, other than to say, the picture seems to be, by the commentators in many ways, what happens when I leave sin in my life with a stronghold. But the picture there in the middle day, they have found a way to curse them without using words. And what he did was to say, look, just get along. That's what the intermarrying is. Just get along. Don't hold your standards. Don't hold that. Just get along. And it's that compromising with evil that is the name that Balaam carries. And it's interesting, the Hebrew name Balaam, I told you for 2 weeks what this meant, do you remember? Conquering the people. Nicolaitan, that are mentioned in there, it's a Greek word, the founder of that, the name in Greek means conquering the people. The picture seems to be that what was happening in Pergamum was the same kinds of issues that Smyrna was facing. Some of those carried further than Smyrna had yet seen. Okay? And yet, what was hiding there was a tendency or an attitude that said, well, you know, this is not enough to worry about. We can compromise with evil here or here and leave the things that are opposed to the Lord's work, leave them in place and leave them a place from which to expand the Lord. And that's what was happening in Pergamum. You want to go back there for just a moment? When they describe the Lord, what's the description? What part of the description of the risen Lord back in chapter 1 did they pull up? Does the writer pull up? The sharp, two-edged sword. And if you remember that image across the New Testament, always talks about cutting through to the heart of things. It's used in terms of the Word of God, something alive and active, able to cut through sinew and tissue, eventually laying bare the truth of the situation. Because the height of what Balaam is famous for is the height of talking about, well, it's not as bad as he said. Absolutely not anything to worry about. And that was what was loose. Take a look. Do not criticize Pergamum too much. Many of the characteristics of Smyrna are still there. The difference with this one, they had left sin a foothold. They had left evil. They had compromised with evil and said, this is okay. This is not a problem. We don't really have to worry about that. And he said, that's enough to put you at rest. We've got Ephesus, we've got Smyrna, we've got Pergamum. Who's next? Okay. If you can pronounce that, then okay, you just have to come to the board and try to write blood clots and stuff. Who's after that? Philadelphia, my other city. Okay, we've got four to go. We might do two next week. Any questions? Any comments? Our Father, more than any time today, based on what we've read and thought about, we pray for you to adjust our value system. The old song said, amazing grace, I sweep the town, the faith that wrecks like me, I once was lost, but now I'm found, was blind, but now I see. He just opened our eyes and see the world, and see the things in the world the way you do. So we're even grinding poverty. Is not necessarily a sign that we're really poor. It can be a sign that we're rich. Because the poverty is something we're enduring in here. But I think at the same time, it calls on us to recognize the troubles that others have and to see those troubles as opportunities for service. Because it's also, you can sit a cup of water getting here in that. It's the greatest thing we can do. Help us be sensitive to the needs around us. Because sometimes it's in those things that you kind of like. All these things we pray in your sanctuary.